It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. We've had 30 years of Prozac. So why are we still depressed?
I was in my early 20s, I think it was 1988, and I was having a complete breakdown. My psychiatrist was about to hospitalize me because I was so suicidal. I didn't want to be hospitalized because I had already been hospitalized like 4 or 5 times prior to this. I didn't want another hospitalization. I would have rather killed myself. My psychiatrist said, well, there's a new drug that's just come on board, and it's called Prozac, and maybe we could try that.
And she did. This is Lauren Slater. She wrote the famous memoir, Prozac Diary, and now she's back with a new one, Blue Dreams, the story of 30 years on SSRIs, which for her has been a really mixed bag. I can relate, and maybe you can too. Like a lot of people, I started taking Prozac around the same time Lauren did. It was 1988 or so, and the drug was brand new. I have this almost physical memory of the first time I opened the bottle and shook this tiny green and cream-colored capsule out into my hand. I remember being scared, because at the time, I thought it was going to make me somebody else. And what did you think?
I vividly remember, you know, the first time I took it. But I remember better the third and fourth time I took it because I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. At first, I thought this couldn't be. I'm just having a good moment. But that moment turned into a day, and that day turned into a week, and that week turned into a month. And I'm someone who lived with psychiatric symptoms since I was 10 years old and probably even before. All of a sudden, I was better. And I had to reckon with what it meant that this pill was making me into a new person. I came to believe it was what I called a psychotropic Drano. It cleared my mind of all of the gunk of obsessions and the gunk of depression. And underneath was the person that I was.
What I remember is I remember feeling like I'd grown a new skin, like I'd finally grown the amount of skin that everybody else was born with and was walking around with all the time. I wasn't walking around raw anymore. I just felt insulated. It was, I can't describe the relief.
Yeah, for me, it was the most miraculous thing that's ever happened to me. And I've had 2 babies, so, and that's supposedly miraculous. And it was miraculous, but it wasn't as miraculous as being cured in a matter of days by a pill.
So you and I weren't the only ones who were having this miraculous come to Prozac experience.
Mm-hmm.
The nation fell in love with Prozac. I mean, this has been going on for 30 years. So by now, it's as though we've undergone this massive national chemistry experiment.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
What's been the long-term effect on you?
Prozac stopped working for me. It wasn't like it's kind of dwindled down. It just stopped. So I had to switch to Effexor. I'm permanently on an SSRI or SSNRI booster. I can't get off. I've tried to get off, and it's not possible for me to do. I don't see that I'll ever be able to get off of it. In the meantime, no one knows. No one really knows what the long-term side effects of the SSRIs are. I've been taking them, you've been taking them for 30 years. We're walking experiments. But the scarier thing than that is that no one's experimenting on us. They should be looking towards us. Our bodies carry the signatures of these drugs, but no one's asking us or looking at us or looking in us to find out what might be the long-term effects. Why are they so hard to get off of? And what happens to the brain if you do get off of them, and what happens to the brain if you don't get off of them. I mean, something is happening to the brain. And after 30 years of marinating your brain in a serotonin booster, clearly the brain has changed, but no one knows how or why.
So how do you feel about this? I mean, from the sound of it, you didn't have a choice. You were suicidal.
I don't feel that I do have a choice. And I get irritated with people who tell me, you know, just try going off of it, because of course I have tried and it's horrible. I take another drug called Zyprexa, which helps boost the efficacy of the Effexor. And the Zyprexa has really, really wreaked havoc with my body. What I feel is that my lifespan is going to be much shorter than it would have been if I hadn't had to take these drugs. Of course, then I probably would have committed suicide. So that's another way of, you know, but I don't think I'm going to live very long because of the side effects of these drugs.
God, what are they for you? That's terrible.
Well, the Zyprexa is, I have type 2 diabetes, and my kidneys, because of the high blood sugar, my kidneys have been damaged. So I have renal insufficiency, which is a progressive thing. So my kidneys will just become less and less able to function. I'm overweight, and that's linked to the type 2 diabetes. My triglycerides are like 800. You can't live very long with triglycerides at 800. I mean, that's poison.
This is awful, but I'm imagining your psychiatrist and your doctor arguing with each other about what's more important, your mind or your body.
Yeah, and it's been, for me, I don't know if it's been this way for you, but for me, the drugs have made my mind and my body starkly divided. Do I put my body before my mind, or my mind before my body? And supposedly, you know, we now know that the mind and the body are one, and that the body gives rise to the mind. But when you take one of these drugs, you realize that's not true. You have to choose which one, your mind or your body. For me, if I don't have my mind, then my body is irrelevant. So I've chosen my mind and a shorter lifespan as a result.
Do you ever, I hesitate to ask this because your symptoms were much more serious than mine, and you really didn't and don't have a choice. Mine weren't nearly as severe. Sometimes I feel guilty because I think I fell for a myth that I wanted to believe, a myth that depression or mental illness really was just like diabetes, and you would not treat your diabetes, right?
Right.
I fell for this myth that I could just treat my mind as separate, just take a pill, and it would all magically be better. And looking back, I think, how stupid was I? Were all of us?
It's not stupidity, because that's exactly what you were probably told, that you had, it was like diabetes and you wouldn't not treat your diabetes. I mean, that's what psychiatrists tell their patients.
Yep.
They tell their patients that they have a chemical imbalance, but there's no proof that depression or any kind of psychiatric disorder is because of a chemical imbalance. What's happened is they've reasoned backwards from the drugs. Because the SSRIs and the SSNRIs, essentially, they raise the levels of serotonin. Depression and other forms of mental illness must be the result of too little serotonin.
Right.
You don't say that when you have strep throat, that it's the result of a lack of penicillin, even though penicillin is what cures the strep throat. Do you see how the logic is wrong?
Yeah.
But people believe, it's problematic to me that everywhere you go, people believe that depression and other psychiatric disorders are the result of low serotonin, when in fact there's no evidence that a chemical imbalance is implicated in any form of mental illness whatsoever. It may turn out that there is a chemical imbalance, but if there is one, it's a lot more complex, I'm sure, than just low serotonin. So it's a giant myth that we're walking around with. And the drug companies and our psychopharmacologist continued to perpetuate that.
So how do you feel about this drug now? I mean, it saved your life.
Yes, it did.
But at the same time, it's destroying your body. Do you feel betrayed, grateful, resentful?
I feel all of those things. I'm angry with Eli Lilly specifically because they make Zyprexa and they make Prozac. And I feel like they put a drug on the market, Zyprexa, which is so deadly. At the same time, it's worked miraculously for me. But isn't there another drug that they could have made that doesn't turn your blood to custard? Because millions and millions of people are on Zyprexa. It's the best-selling antipsychotic in the country. It's a billion-dollar drug.
And do you ever wonder who you'd be if you hadn't taken any of these drugs?
I do wonder that. I wonder if I would have made a suicide attempt or a couple of suicide attempts, and I probably would have survived them. And I wonder if I would have somehow grown out of the misery that I was in. Is it possible that I would have found a sustaining relationship that was supportive to me and my writing, which was so important to me and that I wasn't able to really do because I was so ill, if eventually I would have been able to do my writing and become the things that I wanted to be without the drugs, and if that would have been enough to hold me. But I doubt that. I doubt that I would have gotten any better.
It matters a lot to me that we end this conversation by saying something to all the people, millions of people, who are taking these drugs so that they don't feel guilty or feel scared.
Yeah.
I want to say something reassuring, something so tomorrow morning we can all shake those pills into our hands and live with it.
What I would say is that I feel, for all of the drawbacks, I feel enormously grateful. And gratefulness is, you should be grateful to feel grateful.
Yeah.
Because gratefulness is an incredibly powerful life enhancer. And I could have been permanently lost in the darkness, and I'm not. I'm very much in the light. And I don't take that for granted. Unlike people who haven't struggled with mental illness, they just take for granted that they're in the light. I don't take that for granted. I know that could disappear.
Yeah.
So I live every day powered by and empowered by that gratefulness. I live that by doing things that I love and reveling in the fact that I'm able to do them. I do my writing, and I have my friends, and I have my children, and I have my house, and I love all of them. I love them so much. And these drugs have enabled me to love. When you're depressed, you're not able to really love. So out of the soil of that gratefulness, so many powerful things have grown in my life. And that's an enormous thing to consider.
I'm so glad you're here, and I hope you're here for a long time.
Thank you.
That's Lauren Slater. She wrote the famous memoir Prozac Diary 20 years ago, and her latest book is called Blue Dreams, the science and story of the drugs that changed our minds. Coming up, there should be a better way. And why should somebody like Lauren have to choose between her mind and her body? When we come back, one psychiatrist believes they don't. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Thank you. The dream of Prozac and the SSRIs was based on an idea that depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in the brain, and that you could fix it with a pill. But what if that basic underlying idea was wrong? Well, psychiatrist Charles Raison believes it's a mistake to separate the mind from the body, and he told Steve Paulson that he and his colleagues are studying new ways to treat depression as a disease of the body, not just the brain.
We did a study, five, six, seven, eight, 9 years ago, where we gave people a drug that does not get into the brain. It only works on the immune system in the body. And people that were depressed and had too much of that immune system activation, the drug worked great as an antidepressant. So you could actually treat depression with a drug that never got into the brain just by turning off this immune depression signal that's sort of coming up from the body.
So inflammation can be one cause of depression. So
it is a cause of depression.
So just as inflammation causes, you know, flu or the cold or something
Absolutely.
Like this, you're saying it also can trigger.
Oh, we know so. So this was a lot of, if you Googled me, a lot of the work I've been known for over the years was inflammation, looking at how does inflammation in the body make the brain depressed? And the answer is that inflammation looks a lot like psychological stress. If your body gets inflamed, you get almost all the changes in your brain and the stress system that you do when you're under psychological stress. And sickness looks a lot like depression. It's really very interesting. So, for instance, no surprise that the flu is associated with a fever, but many of us don't realize that depressed people also run a chronic elevation in their body temperature. They're wandering around a couple of degrees too hot, just like people do when they're sick. And you treat them, and their body temperature goes back down to normal.
So if I have a fever, I take ibuprofen.
Yes.
Does that help with depression?
Well, that's an interesting question. If you are depressed, should you take an anti-inflammatory? And we did that study, and the answer is only if you're inflamed. You can be just as depressed and not be inflamed at all, and then you don't want to take an anti-inflammatory. So it's not that depression is an inflammatory condition. It's that inflammation is one of the ways that people can get depressed.
You know what I find so fascinating about this whole conversation is I'm sure depression is one of the major causes of disability.
It's number one.
Number one
in the world right now.
Number one in the world.
Yeah.
But we still don't know so much about it. I assume there's still a huge amount of debate about the most effective treatments.
There is. We know what causes depression from the environment. What we don't understand of what causes depression is the genetic piece. That has really been a mystery. You're right. There is a lot of debate about the best way to treat it. And I torture my brain with this because it is really a difficult problem. Now in the United States, most people that are depressed get an antidepressant agent.
Right.
And, you know, I'm a psychopharmacologist. If you come see me as a doc, that's my expertise. And yet I have profoundly ambivalent feelings about
it. So you're a little reluctant about prescribing Prozac or Zoloft or, you know, one of those pills.
I'm more reluctant than I used to be. If you came to see me as a patient and you were really depressed, I would write you for one of those medicines. And I would sit down and think with you about how can we figure out how to use this medication as a stopgap measure to try to then stabilize you enough that we can try to go in and see if we can't get a deeper cure. There's always a biology and there's always a story.
So there's not a specific genetic blueprint for depression.
Nobody has yet identified a single gene that is a risk factor for depression. There have been studies finding that there's a gene that's sort of a risk factor in white folks, you know, European descent, but then it turns out not to be a risk factor in the Chinese or vice versa. So depression is never going to be solved, I think, in a simple way.
And yet, clearly, genes play a huge factor in all of this. Depression runs through families.
There's no doubt about it. There's famous papers. Where's the missing genetic, you know? Right. I mean, we think that depression is 40% genetic, maybe something like that. Depression is genetic, but it's not genetic in a simple way. So there's a number of genes that they are big risk factors for depression if they are connected with, like, say, a bad childhood. Right? So there's this one serotonin gene that's very famous. And there's several studies showing that if you have that gene and you have early life abuse or neglect, you are very likely to get depressed, especially if you're a woman. Same gene, and you have a really good childhood, you're actually less likely to get depressed. It's a sensitivity gene, not a depression gene. So I don't know that we're ever going to find a gene for depression. What we're going to find are genes that are advantageous in certain types of environments and problematic in others.
So you said that you are reluctant to prescribe SSRIs. you want to find a deeper cause.
I use pharmacologic agents, but I increasingly want to help people get to where they don't have to take that medicine for the rest of their life to feel okay.
So where do you go for that deeper root of depression?
Well, yeah. So this is how I came to do the work I do, right? I think that depression very often is a narrative disorder. And by that, I mean it's caused by the stories that we tell in our heads, and it's caused by the things that have happened to us because that's where many of our stories come from.
That's fascinating. You're suggesting that like one person might have a positive gloss on a difficult thing that happened. The other person would see
it in
a totally depressing way.
Absolutely.
And then the outcome will be entirely different.
Totally different. You see this in response to trauma. Or you see this in response to cancer. That's where I've seen it a lot. So yes, there are certain mental states that make depression almost impossible. And those mental states have been identified for thousands of years. They're often couched in religious terms. There are certain states of compassion and gratitude towards the fact that one exists. You don't recognize the world necessarily as being a perfect place, but it's just so touching that we've all been here for this minute and that it's so amazing that we've been here. When one gets into that state, and that state is felt throughout the whole body, you cannot get depressed. The problem, of course, is that getting into that state is not very easy.
Right. I mean, there are long traditions, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition of, you know, specifically compassion meditation.
Absolutely.
Which is not just, you know, any kind of garden variety mindfulness.
It's a very specific
kind of thing.
So this is why I've spent years, you know, a lot of the work we've done is studying compassion meditation. If you really put me to the wall and say, you know, what do I think at core? That's what I think at core. I think that there are these mental states that make something like depression almost impossible and are very protective, even in rough circumstances. It's hard to get to those positions, though, without having a sort of cracking of one's emotional heart open. There has to be a softness that occurs, that if one can open one's mind and heart in a particular way that has the kind of acceptance that liberates you from all this self-referential thinking that's you're sort of set free. The world doesn't have to revolve around you. When you can achieve that state, that is the ultimate antidepressant, I think. I really believe that. Hmm.
So speaking of narratives, Chuck, I'm wondering if there is a story to tell for you. You've been studying this for years.
Oh, I have been studying this for years.
Why did you get so interested in trying to grapple with this whole big problem of depression?
Well, I think like all psychiatrists, because I'm vulnerable to it myself, I will tell you a story because some of the other work I've done is actually around other novel ways of treating depression. For instance, we're very interested in heat, hyperthermia. Many years ago now, I was preparing to go to medical school, and I was having a very rough winter. I'd gotten rejected from all but two. I applied to 18 medical schools. Nobody wanted me, and it was a massive blow to my self-esteem. Anyway, so it was over this winter, I got really depressed. And then, interestingly, I got the flu. I really got the flu. And it had this weird paradoxical effect that when I got this fever, my depression totally went away. And I went into this state, like we were talking about a second ago, of this feeling of profound sort of wonder and gratitude and just so happy to be alive exactly as I was with all my failings. And it was a powerful cure, man. I mean, I just went for years. I never felt bad again. And so I came out of that and I was like, what the heck? Why would getting sick and have a fever? It put me into this mystical space, right? And
I thought the fever was supposed to have just the opposite effect. It was supposed to make you more depressed.
It does. Well, yeah, if we had another hour, we'd talk about the complexities of the immune system. No, it turns out that in people that are very depressed, have been depressed for a while, there's actually a study from Europe showing that if you shoot them up with bacteria and they get a fever, they actually, like I did, get this really powerful antidepressant response. That got me interested in heat. Heat led me to Tibetan Buddhism because they have these very, very amazing techniques for basically raising body temperature. And they think that those techniques are the core to all their deepest practices. And then that led me to this curiosity of why would how you regulate temperature of your body have anything to do with depression? And I began to notice something interesting, which is that a lot of these novel sort of biological things that we were finding had already been claimed for many, many years by what I sometimes call ancient practices, right?
I was thinking when you were talking about heat, you were going to talk about the old Native American practice of sweat lodges.
Absolutely. Sweat lodges are everywhere in the world. The use of heat for spiritual purposes, for healing, for the induction of stress resilience, it's just ubiquitous, right? Why would people voluntarily put themselves in a little bitty tent-like sweat lodge? It's like 190 degrees in there. You're suffocating. It's miserable. You think you're going to die. And we now know the answer is because there are pathways that run from the body to the brain, especially from the skin to the brain, that when they're stimulated by heat, they produce changes in brain chemicals that have an antidepressant effect. We got this fancy, you know, heat hypothermia machine. It's not the fancy machine. It's the heat.
Tell me about that machine. You go into it, it's like some hot box.
Mm-hmm. It's like a hot box. You lay down. It's like a tent. It covers your whole body. Your head's out. It's got these big infrared kind of bulbs that shoot down on your chest. And it kind of heats you up from the inside. So it gets you hotter a little bit more comfortably than something like a sauna.
How hot does it get?
Well, in the chamber itself, not that hot. It only gets up to about 150 degrees.
That sounds pretty hot.
Yeah, it's hot. But we treat people up to a core body temperature of just a little bit under 102. And it's very hot. I've done it to myself to see what it's like. It's the hottest I've ever been.
And how long are people in this machine?
About 2 hours, usually. It does something to the immune system. It looks exactly like what exercise does. Now, we don't know why that makes you underpressed with exercise, but I suspect that there's something that the immune system's doing that we don't understand yet.
What's so striking about so many of these examples you've been using, the sweat lodge, mindfulness,
compassion meditation,
they all come out of spiritual traditions. Yep. It suggests there's maybe some mystical component here.
See, I think there is. So I think what we're doing with something like a sweat lodge is we're taking that signal that you need to have at a certain level just to feel normal, and we're pushing it. We're supercharging it. You can take these pathways that evolve to make you feel like, I'm okay. And if you really hit them, you can induce these very powerful and sometimes euphoric states of mind. For those of us that are depressed, helping to find that thing that opens up this state of grace, that I think is really the core challenge. I think, surprisingly, I think we'll find a cure for autism. I don't think we're going to find a cure for depression, even though autism seems so much worse. I think with depression, what we're going to find is that life has always been suffering and that it's an ongoing job to live an optimal human life. Getting to that state, there's going to be many roads to Rome, I think.
Charles Raison is a psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Medical School and co-author of the book The New Mind-Body Science of Depression. He talked with Steve Paulson. So if we can find new cures for mental illness in practices like sweat lodges, which have been around for centuries, where else could we look?
There's a place called Lithium Springs in Georgia. In the 19th century and early 20th century, it was a major destination spa in the United States, with four presidents, including Teddy Roosevelt, going there for the waters. It seems to have been some kind of ritual site for Native Americans, because there are these mounds and sites that have been excavated. The biggest hotel in the southeast of the United States was in Lithium Springs. And after I wrote the piece for The Times, I got hundreds of calls of people saying, where do I get it?
Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm thinking.
They had produced this water until relatively recently, and apparently the factory burned down a few years ago.
Lithium water. If it was good enough for U.S. presidents, how about the rest of us? Coming up, the case for microdosing with stardust. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We'll be right back.
don't know about you, but recently I've been hearing a lot about microdosing with LSD. I've read articles, books, seen seminars, lab research about it. Well, psychiatrist Anna Fels has a new microdosing proposal. Not with a drug, but with an element. Lithium, which is number 3 on the periodic table. She wrote an op-ed for the New York Times recently that caused quite a stir. The title was, "Should We All Take a Bit of Lithium?" Here, wait, I want to read you the first paragraph. "The idea of putting a mind-altering drug in the drinking water is the stuff of sci-fi, terrorist plots, and totalitarian governments. Considering the outcry that occurred when putting fluoride in the water was first proposed, one can only imagine the furor that would ensue if such a thing were ever suggested." If you were made water czar of the U.S., would you actually consider adding a tiny bit of lithium to America's drinking water?
No. I would make it available to people in vitamin pills so that it was voluntary. And I don't think we have enough studies at this point to say everybody in the country should be taking microdoses of lithium. You know, I think that there's very suggestive evidence that it's useful both in terms of reducing impulsivity, irritability, suicidality, that there's enough evidence so people should have the option of taking microdoses, especially since there seemed to be no downside to it.
Well, let's back up for a minute and give me some basic education, because I thought lithium was one of those really heavy-duty drugs used to treat people with major bipolar disorder or really intractable depression.
It is. It's utilized primarily for those two things. And for those diagnoses, usually the dose is between, say, 600 and 2400 milligrams of lithium per day. And the doses that are found in water systems are in the order of 30 to 200 micrograms. That's 1,000 times less than a milligram. Much, much less.
What makes anybody think that tiny amount would have any effect on the brain?
Well, a study was done in Texas quite a while back. I don't know what possessed the scientists to look into it, but Texas has unusually high levels of lithium in some of its counties, not all of them. And he began looking at suicide rates and rates of violent behavior, homicide, rape, etc., in areas that had significant amounts of lithium in the water system. By significant, again, I mean these micro levels versus those that had much lower levels. And to his astonishment and everybody else's, he found that in the areas that had the higher lithium in the groundwater, there were 40% fewer suicides, there were fewer rapes, there were fewer violent crimes.
40%?
Yeah.
That's huge.
It is huge.
So areas with more lithium in the drinking water, the suicide rate can be as much as 40% lower? Why isn't that major headline news?
Well, precisely. After the Texas study, it was reproduced in multiple countries with very large numbers of subjects in the studies, and this included Japan, Austria, Greece. And in those countries, it was found that there was a correlation between reduced suicidality and higher levels of lithium in the water systems. Out of the studies that have been done, and now there are quite a few, it really does seem like there is some significant effect on suicidality.
So at the moment, there's this naturally occurring element. There's significant demographic studies indicating that it has, in microdoses, small amounts, it's really beneficial for people. And yet, in the U.S. at least, most of us have no idea how much of it we're getting in our groundwater, if any.
That's correct.
And there are very few studies done on it.
Right. I think in the U.S., the only one I know of is Texas.
Why?
You know, it's a great question. I think there are a number of reasons. One is that in the 19th century, as I said, in the early 20th century, lithium was everywhere. It was in beers, in medicine, it was in beverages. 7-Up was originally called lithiated lemon-lime soda.
There was lithium in 7-Up.
Yes,
so
actually,
maybe the up referred to its effect on mood.
Totally. And there's speculation that 7 comes from the molecular weight of lithium.
Wow. I'm still kind of surprised, though, given the studies that you've mentioned, that one of the big drug companies hasn't come out with it, because aren't they all looking for the next silver bullet for depression?
You would think, but you know, one of the problems for them with lithium is that it's an element. You can't patent it. It's very cheap. There are medications that cost tens or hundreds of dollars a day. Lithium costs about 10 to 20 cents a day.
Not a lot of money to be made there.
Not a lot of money to be made.
Well, you and other psychiatrists are starting to talk about this a little bit more. Is anybody taking lithium a little more seriously? Are any new studies starting?
Not that I know of. I mean, there have been very few recent studies that I've seen about the microdose lithium. There have been some extremely important articles about using lithium for bipolar disorder, confirming its anti-suicidal effects. And in bipolar disorder, it's particularly important because about 25 to 50% of bipolar patients attempt suicide, and nearly 20% do kill themselves.
Wow.
It's an extremely high mortality. And lithium in the higher doses given for bipolar disorder is the only medication that's been shown to reduce that mortality. And it reduces it pretty dramatically, 13-fold. So there have been studies recently looking at that, showing how important an effect it has for this population, but not the microdoses.
And yet, you wrote in that Times piece that working as a psychiatrist, for your patients, lithium is a hard sell compared to other mood disorder medications. How come?
Well, part of it is this general reputation of it being a sort of heavy-duty medication, which is in one sense true in that you have to get blood levels. There's some small amount of patient education that's required. You have to monitor renal function and thyroid function, which can be serious side effects of lithium. So it's not an easy medication to give compared to certain others. But the other medications that are given for bipolarity also have extremely serious potential side effects. For some reason, the medical and psychiatric community has seen those as less problematic, even though, for example, valproate, which is usually given as the first-line medication for bipolarity and mood regulation, can cause things like aplastic anemia, you know, platelet dysfunction, you know, lots of serious side effects. But lithium has somehow gotten this reputation of being the hardest medication to monitor, which is, it's a little bit harder, but it's worth it.
Anna Fells. Her degree is from Harvard Medical School, and she's been a practicing psychiatrist for more than 20 years. If you want to read her essay, Should We All Take a Bit of Lithium?, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. And hey, while you're there, sign up for our newsletter. It's a weekly dip into the TT Book hive mind, where we share stuff that we're reading and listening to and thinking about.
There was a fire, and it triggered this manic episode. I happened to not be on lithium at the time.
This is Jamie Lowe. She's manic, and this is one of her worst memories.
I was convinced that I had to produce and execute this elaborate and enormous First Amendment rights, we are the world type benefit concert.
There comes a time. Hi! When we heed a sign.
The problem is there was no concert, no benefit, nothing except in Jamie's mind. But that didn't stop her calling and visiting music executives, trying to book concert venues and print posters. Talk about embarrassing.
I didn't feel any humiliation in it, but I think in retrospect, when I came to the realization that that probably wasn't something that was appropriate or gonna happen, I was like, I'm not sure why I showed up in all of those people's offices randomly while I was kind of this raving lunatic. It doesn't sound like a real manic thing or even particularly destructive, but when I think about that, I want to crawl under a table.
Jamie tells this story and more in a new memoir called Mental: Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. Charles Monroe Kane shares the same mental illness, so his first question to Jamie, why would you go off your meds?
Twofold. I didn't think I was manic, so I was like, I don't need those still. This is amazing. Why would I ever take them? I was trying to generate this whole thing for the First Amendment rights, you know, free world, right, whatever, concert that nobody was actually engaged in except for me. I just was like wandering the city and felt like I was experiencing life in this amazing way. And that was the good side.
Were you?
Yeah.
You were experiencing life in a good way. It was awesome, right?
It was. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that can top what being manic feels like. And that's kind of the worst part of it.
Right.
I mean, it's like this, it's a mind fuck. I mean, you're totally not in this world and you're completely, It's like I think about it longingly sometimes, but I know what happens next. And that's the worst part. And it's so destructive and so difficult. And I think about my family. I think about my loved ones now. And I'm like, you know, would never wish for it, but it's a lot like addiction. It's a lot like that kind of mentality where you get that high and you're just like, why would I let this go?
You know, one thing that happens is drugs. Just so many pharmaceutical medications to experiment with and take, and the psychiatrist tries this. Have you done like all of them? Like, have you just tried a million different meds?
I haven't.
Oh, you haven't?
No. Lithium was always like the one soulmate true love drug. And I just stayed on it until I was 25. So that was like 7 or 8 years.
And now you're on this med that kind of works. You got a supportive family. You're pretty young. Why'd you quit? Why'd you stop taking them, man?
Well, it's easy to think, A, that you're young when you're 25, when you're actually 25. It was fine. I was in my early 20s. I was drinking a lot, probably too much. I was eating a lot of egg and cheese sandwiches. I basically felt like I had a normal life, and I had this relationship with a psychiatrist who I'd been seeing for a couple of years in New York, and we kind of had talked about, well, maybe that was a one-time thing that I had this really severe manic episode, and maybe it's not something I need. And when you're faced with the question of, do I need this, or can I function just on my own without a medication, your body, your mind, and your soul wants to believe I can be just me without it. It wasn't because lithium was bad. It was because I just was thinking maybe I didn't need it.
Which makes sense because you were feeling fine.
Right, because of the lithium.
That's the thing, right?
Right.
Hey, you write something in the book, and I find this extremely profound, this statement. I want to read it to you that you wrote. The further away you get from it all, the less intense the memory. And I thought, damn, that's why we quit taking it.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're a grown up. I'm a grown up. We both take meds. How do you remember why to stay on now?
Why do I stay on it now? Well, sometimes I think I shouldn't, which is the wrong thing to think, I would say. And sometimes I think that I don't know. It's a tough question, but I feel like I need it. I have people who tell me, who I trust and love, who tell me I need it, and I believe them. And I just feel like You know, I'm in this stable, loving relationship that I really cherish, and I have a home that I also love in Flatbush, Brooklyn, and I feel like I can focus on writing pretty well and that my life is really, really good and I'm lucky and I don't want it to get psycho, for lack of a better word.
No, psycho is the great word, man. But I feel like in the back of my head, there's a special me and he gets dampened by lithium. And it's society's fault that they can't accept me, the shaman of the tribe. You know what I mean? Did you ever feel that way?
So, you know, I'm going to rely on a crutch here. I'm going to rely on Chris Gethard, who is a comedian who says basically that the myth of the musician or the artist who can only rely on being crazy to be real and to create is just that it's a myth and that you can't actually wake up and function without the medication. And so you can't be a comedian if you don't have that medication to be that person. And I would say that, you know, I'd throw it back to you and just say that you are who you are because of the medication, because you're allowed to function. And the special you, who I know what you're talking about, right. And I miss that person too, that person can't exist for more than like 8 days. And that's not a life.
You know, Jamie, clearly lithium worked for you, but at the same time, it was also slowly destroying your kidneys. I mean, your kidney health issues were getting worse and worse and worse. And eventually you had to quit lithium or risk complete renal failure. What happened?
It wasn't so sudden. I knew that my kidneys were going slowly south and that was a result of the lithium. And it was something that I monitored with my psychiatrist. You know, I'm not the best at doing blood work. I try really hard to do it regularly, but I think it was terrifying in that just the idea of having to find a new medication is just really scary.
No, I know. But you have this pill that you've been taking since you've been 16 off and on that really meant a lot to you, lithium. You knew your body couldn't take it anymore. Your kidneys couldn't handle it anymore. So you had to say goodbye to it, right? How did you say goodbye to lithium?
No, I didn't do a proper goodbye. I wanted to do something nice for lithium because it was a good thing for me, even though it kind of busted my kidneys. But I think, well, I guess, you know what? I'm going to take that back. I think this book is like a big tribute to lithium. So I thought a lot about it and I wrote a lot about it. And this is a little bit of a love song to it, I hope. Because even though we had like a tragic parting, it really gave me a lot of years of great life. And I am so grateful for that. But I did kind of want to have some weird shamanistic ceremony secretly, but I didn't. I was spent, and by the time I was at the end of the lithium, I kind of was like, peace out, bye. Later.
Later, lithium. Later, right. LI3, sup.
Exactly.
Hey, can you do me a favor? Can you do a reading for me from your book? It's on 284.
Yes. Who am I in relationship to the medication, to the disease, to my experience? How did lithium shape me? It gave me 24 years of sanity, to live, to grow, to love, to flourish, and to fail. But here's the thing. I'm among the 1% of the mentally ill. I'm the luckiest mentally ill person. I'm the mentally illest. I was lucky. I have a family that supports me and understands me. Most don't. I was lucky. I was born into a family with enough money that I knew I would be financially supported if absolutely necessary, and I would have health coverage no matter what. Most people can't afford a Band-Aid and a neck brace. I was lucky. When my life burned down, my industry, family, and friends forgave me and helped me rebuild. I was lucky. I had several psychiatrists walk me through this shit. Most people don't even get a social worker. I was lucky. My kidney is degenerating. I really really almost got through it.
It's okay.
Okay. My kidney is degenerating, but Dr. Lane and Dr. Schwartz caught it in time, and Dr. DeVita is nursing it along. Some people lose their kidney function altogether. I was lucky. I get to experience all of life, one I would never trade for normal, whatever that is. I'm lucky. Not everyone is.
That's Jamie Lowe, talking with Charles Monroe Kane. They've each written memoirs about living with mania. Jamie's is called Mental, Lithium, Love, and Losing My Mind. And Charles's is called Lithium Jesus. So before we go, I want to say there are a lot of us who struggle with mood disorders or mental illness of one sort or another. And if you do, we want you to know that you're not alone. Plus, we have a present for you. Charles made a playlist of music he listens to when he's down and needs a lift. It's not like fake happy song kind of lift. It's something more honest, but also hopeful. You heard a few bits and pieces in today's show, but we put the full hour-long playlist on our website for you. You'll find it at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show, with help from Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.